702.
Asanya Mosaka. Lines are always open.
On 011-883-0702.
We've got Professor Chris Smith now with us on the line, and we're taking your calls on 011-883-0702, 31702 for your SMSs. What is your science-related question for Chris Smith? Good afternoon, Chris.
Oh, hi, Alza. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. And first up, I need to know, what is an exoplanet?
Well, we now know about 5,000 or more of them. And in fact, the Nobel Prize was awarded for their discovery. Didier Queloz, who's a researcher here at the University of Cambridge, was one of the co-winners for the discovery of one of the first exoplanets. Exoplanets, put simply, are planets orbiting stars that are not our own sun. So in other words, one of the other of the probably a couple of hundred billion stars in the Milky Way or stars in other galaxies.
Wow. And I remember the last time we had this question about the shape of the universe, and you mentioned how many galaxies there are. Where is this exoplanet? Do we know?
Oh, well, there are thousands of them. So there are lots and lots of different planets. I don't know where this precise one is.
Okay.
If you said to me, can you point to that in the night sky? I wouldn't be able to give you the first clue, to be honest. But, I mean, the thing is that when this was first a thing, actually discovering remote planets, people thought we could never do this, because what you're trying to do, it's a bit like weighing the captain of a ship by weighing the ship and the captain, then
right.
Taking the captain off the ship and reweighing the ship again. It's a tiny, tiny difference that you're able to see in the light from the distant star in order to see these planets. So it really is a feat of amazing astronomy that
yes.
They've managed to do this. But it's now become fairly de rigueur to do this, to the extent that someone wrote to me the other day and they managed to see an exoplanet themselves using a kit they built and bought off the internet in their back garden. They didn't see the exoplanet in their back garden. Obviously, they put the telescope in their back garden and they knew where to look because people had already discovered the exoplanet they spotted. But the point is that you can now fairly routinely do this.
Yeah.
But when they first started doing all this stuff, it was really tough.
Yes. Well, I'm inclined to go for Skeletium and Buchu. And then my second options would be Ingoma and Ubunye. I just love the idea of drawing from the fauna for these name inspirations. But nonetheless, South Africans have an opportunity to vote for the exoplanet and star. So we're taking your calls this afternoon.
We're going to call it sort of Planety McPlanet Face, which was the boat that ended up being called Boaty McBoat Face.
Oh, no.
You have to be careful when you invite people to vote on things, as the British Antarctic Survey found out.
Well, at least we have a short list here, so it's a little guided and managed.
Exactly.
All right, so we're taking your call 011-883-0702 for Professor Chris Smith. Let's start with Brett. Brett, thanks for your patience. You're calling from Four Ways. Hi.
Yes, hi. Chris, I was wondering, I've been aware of gout and, you know, symptoms of excessive acidity in my body. And I went to the chemist and they said, well, there's a little litmus paper thingy you can buy. You put it on your saliva and it'll tell you whether you're too acidic or not. Now, from you actually telling me, the body regulates your acidity very, very acutely. So I was wondering if that actually would make a difference. Would you be able to see your body's level of acidity by using litmus paper on your saliva?
Oh.
Hello, Brett. The answer is that, well, you can make measurements of your body's pH, pH being the measure of how acid or alkaline the body is.
Mm-hmm.
But you're quite right that the body exerts very strict and rigid control over the pH, because if it doesn't, then all kinds of systems don't work properly, because the enzymes and the proteins that keep our body ticking over like clockwork are optimized to work at a very specific and very narrow range of acidity. And this is about 7.4. So our body fluids are just slightly into the alkaline side of being neutral. So yes, you could take some body fluids and you could put some litmus paper on it. But the thing is, it's only going to tell you what the pH of that particular tissue is, because the body's fluids might be at 7.4. But if I took some stomach acid, for example, that's going to be pH 1. If I took some urine, my urine might be acid one day and alkaline another day, because you control your body's pH by throwing away acid or alkali in your urine in order to regulate the metabolism. So if I went to the top of a mountain, for example, say Everest, I'd have to breathe really hard in order to get enough oxygen into me, because the air is much thinner at the top of Everest. The act of breathing much harder would lead to the loss of a lot of CO2 from my body. I'd breathe out more CO2 than I actually was making. Because CO2 is acidic when it dissolves in the blood, this would make my blood very alkaline, so my urine would subsequently become really alkaline to compensate. But if I did the same test before I did that, I wouldn't register really, really alkaline urine. I'd be registering slightly acid urine. So you have to be really cautious. It sounds a little bit snake oily to me. The fact is your body is very, very good at regulating its pH, and when it goes wrong, there's all kinds of bad consequences. So I don't think the resolution of a piece of litmus paper or something on your tongue is going to be anything like accurate enough to yield useful information.
Brett?
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the question. I was also curious about which would be the best place. You know, is the, you know, the saliva in our mouths the best place to measure that? Because it's probably different everywhere. Thank you. Next, let's go to Jay calling from Alberton. Hello, Jay.
Hi, Azza. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's actually my sister that has the question.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to ask now.
Hi.
Hi, Jay, sister. What's your name?
Isha.
Isha. Thank you, Isha. How old are you?
9.
You're 9. All right. The naked scientist is listening.
How do they calculate the point system on the JSE?
The point system on the JSE. So do you listen to the financial news when they give all those indicators?
Yes.
Okay. What a great question, Isha. Any idea how the point system's calculated? On the stock exchange?
The foggiest. Hello, Easter, by the way. Do you know, I haven't got the foggiest what the answer to that is. I'd need to do a bit of reading. It's not a question I was expecting. I don't know anything about it. I'm sorry. I'd have to look it up.
Isha, so we'll look it up and then make an appointment for you to listen into the answer, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, the 9-year-old's got you stumped, Chris.
Oh, she has as well. They always ask the best questions.
Yeah, I know.
And I don't want to come out with stuff that's wrong, especially when 9-year-old people are listening, and then they'll say, "Well, you see, you got it wrong."
Yeah.
So I need to go and brush up on how the stock exchange is working.
All right. Next, let's go to Poloso in Edenvale. Hi, Poloso.
Hello, Azza. Hi, Chris. I just want to find out, you know, papala, hangover.
Yes.
How does it happen? Just because you have too much alcohol in your body, or like what constitutes that and how to mitigate it?
I knew that was
when I take one cider in the morning.
Okay, Poloso. I knew that second part was coming. He wants to know how a hangover happens, and is there anything to mitigate its effects?
Well, the best thing to do is to not get one in the first place,
yeah,
to be honest with you.
Agree.
Because if you get symptoms, it means you've definitely overdone it. And if you've overdone it, you've definitely done damage to your body. And that means you've irreversibly lost brain cells. You've aged your body faster than it was otherwise going to age. Why do we get a hangover? Well, there's several reasons. One is that alcohol causes a degree of dehydration because it's a diuretic, so it makes you wee more. So you wee out more liquid than you're putting in eventually, and this leads to a state of dehydration. The second thing is that when alcohol gets metabolized, it's metabolized chiefly in the liver, alcohol dehydrogenase enzymes break down the alcohol molecule, and on the way to turning it into things that are harmless, they also produce intermediaries, one of which is called acetaldehyde or ethanol. And this is a very similar chemical to embalming fluid, the stuff that we put into bodies to stop them rotting when they're in the mortuary.
Yes.
And you're making this in your own bloodstream. So effectively, you are embalming some of your tissues with these rather nasty chemicals. So there's a double whammy. One, the dehydration and the loss of salts. Two, the embalming fluid effect from the toxic intermediates of breaking down the alcohol. And the other thing to consider is that when you metabolize alcohol, you also rob away from your tissues the ability to produce new sugars that you can use for metabolism. So alcohol in excess also tends to make you a bit sugar deficient, and therefore you feel hungry, you feel cranky, and you feel really listless. So the best treatment when this has happened is to put back the salts and sugars you've lost. So some sweet tea or something is a good place to start because it's liquid, it's got salts and sugars in it. A couple of paracetamol and learn your lesson would be my other bit of guidance.
Can we have you give the lesson on why not to drink in high schools? Because after hearing about embalming fluid... I'm horrified that I ever drank. Okay, let's take a break with the Naked Scientist. We'll come back to more of your questions after that.
702.
Asanya Mosaka. Lines are always open.
On 011-883-0702.
It's 9 minutes to 3 o'clock, and we're back with your science-related questions for Professor Chris Smith. Let's go to Dennis in Foys. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there, Aza, and hi to Professor Chris. My question is around blood pressure measurement. I'm told that the optimum time to take a blood pressure reading is in the morning after having a glass of water.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Is that true? Is that the best time, Chris?
Hello, Dennis. The answer is that blood pressure is a really dynamic thing. In other words, it changes all the time, and it changes in response to what you're doing. So if you're in a really relaxed situation, then you're going to have a much lower blood pressure than if you've just run for a bus, you're stressed about making a meeting, someone's run over your cat that morning and you forgot to buy the flowers for the anniversary that you've forgotten about, and now you're in big trouble with the other half as well, etc., etc. So all these things can drive up blood pressure. So you have to consider when is representative of your average day, and take your blood pressure at the same time on an average day, and be prepared to accept the fact that you shouldn't just do it once. And when you go and see a doctor, they'll never take your blood pressure just once. They'll take it maybe on one occasion once, but then they'll come back and see you lots of times. Or they may say to you, go home and take your blood pressure at home in the evening when you're calm, because this will give us a much better representation of what your normal baseline blood pressure is. Never take your blood pressure after you've been out on a bender. We were talking about drinking and hangovers earlier. Alcohol is a really good way to drive up blood pressure, and most people will be a bit hypertensive, have higher blood pressure after they have had a drinking binge. So avoid stimuli like that or situations like that when measuring blood pressure, and try to be representative of when a good time, when you're not subject to excessive stress, because otherwise you'll get a reading which is really high, and then you'll worry about it, which will make you even more worried, which will make you even more stressed, which will make your blood pressure even higher. So try and take a time that's the same time every day, consistently measure it, and don't worry about it, and then you'll get a reasonable indication of what it's really like. And then you can tell your doctor those numbers, and then they can decide whether treatment is necessary or not.
Thank you for the question, Dennis. Next we go to Shepherd. Hi, Shepherd.
Hi, how are you, Aza?
Good, and you?
I'm okay, man. I just have got a short question. You know, on the medical services, like your ambulances and all that,
yeah,
there's a snake, there's a symbol on that sign, there's a snake that rose on that cross. What does that mean?
Right, okay, and why is it associated with medicine? Chris?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never wondered that. I'm going to have to say I'll take a rain check or even a snake check on that one and have a look, because obviously there's going to be some historical point to this, and I'm sure someone listening to this will know and will probably get in touch with us right now. But if no one does before the end of the program, then I will take that away as homework and come back to you next week. I've been got twice today.
Just the homework keeps mounting. Shepherd, that's an undertaking we're making. And let's see if someone is able to call before we end our conversation with Chris to offer an answer. But if not, then next week we'll start with that, actually, to answer the Shepherd's question about the sword and the snake associated with medicine. Probably goes back to the Greeks or all those years ago. Let's go to Spiwe in Midrand. Hello, Spiwe.
Good afternoon. Are you, Aza?
Very good.
Chris.
Yes.
I'm very good. I'd like to know regarding HIV. There is what is called discordant partners. I would like to know what is the scientific explanation of them, of one of them being positive and the other being negative, even though they do get into sexual intercourse without the use of a condom. And whether is it possible for the negative partner to infect the positive one, to infect the negative one through bodily fluids like your sweat or saliva, pre-cutting and all that.
Okay.
Chris. I'll listen on the radio.
Hello,
thank you, Spiwe.
Thank you for the questions. Right, first of all, HIV is a viral infection, and it's in pretty much all body fluids, but at some at higher levels than others.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which this virus transmits, it can be transmitted through dirty needles. So if you are a drug user and you share needles, because those needles are in contact with the bloodstream, you can transmit it that way. Sex is probably the most common in terms of numbers way in which this is transmitted, again, because there's body fluid contact between body fluids and mucous membranes. Mucous membranes are things like the inside of your genital tract, the eyes, mouth, etc. So any contact of a body fluid that could be infectious with those surfaces can allow the virus to transmit. The risk, though, from a splash injury is relatively low. So in a person who is not high levels of infectivity with the virus, the risk of actually picking it up is quite low. Now, why you have these serodiscordant couples? What tends to happen, if you measure somebody and you find that they have got HIV and you test their partner, which is what we would always do to make sure that someone hasn't given it to the other or find out if they have, is you sometimes find that there's one person from a couple who has got it, one who hasn't. Now, it might well be that they just haven't had sex often enough yet to transmit it, because it takes obviously an amount of time. You're not guaranteed if you go with somebody that you're going to pass it on that one occasion. Mm-hmm. It might be that they've been lucky so far. You should never take risks, but they might have been lucky thus far. Mm. On the other hand, there might be a reason why that person has not managed to transmit it to the other partner. And this might be because, for instance, some people have a genetic change in them that makes them much less susceptible to catching HIV, and they might be in that situation. So there's a range of reasons why that a couple can have one of them having HIV and not the other, but it's certainly eminently possible for a person who has HIV to transmit it to another person, and therefore people should practice safe sex. And other body fluids can also transmit the virus, not saliva. The risk of that is very, very low, so kissing, not a problem at all. Okay. But certainly things, anything with blood and other body fluids can transmit it, and you shouldn't take risks with those.
And discordant, as you say, it's a matter of time.
Well, it can be, because if a person has it and then they have the more contact they have with a person, more sexual contact, the more risks there are, or the more opportunities there are for the virus to transmit.
Right.
It tends to be easier for the virus to go from a man to a woman than from a woman to a man for various reasons.
Yes, yes, anatomical reasons. Thank you so much, Chris. We will definitely be together again next week Monday at the same time, and we'll hopefully resolve some of the questions that have come up today.
Yeah, I've got my homework. I'm going to go and stuck into that right now.
Thank you. That is Professor Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist.